Well, the big are getting really big. How big, you ask? Five banks now hold 56% of all our money. One grocer now sells 25% of all our food. One website now sells 33% of everything we buy online. These giants lead us to ask, can we shop our way back to a stronger local economy?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 804th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Ushuaia who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metroforum.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Rick Gaucher on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, a confession. Having authored a book advocating the potential of local agriculture and served on the board of an organization that advocates thinking local first, and work as the general manager of a locally owned radio group, I simply must confess to being a localist. I believe that to survive the economic crash that is coming our way, as certain as a runaway freight train, we simply must learn how to take care of ourselves right here in our own hometown. There will be no one else to do it. And so I look with hope to the signs of emerging localism. Since 1994, the number of farmers markets in the U.S. has increased from 1,744 to 7,864. And more than 1,400 local grocers have opened their doors in neighborhoods across the land. But optimism can only carry one so far, because in the U.S., business continues to grow big, bigger, biggest. Five U.S. banks now hold 56% of all of our money. Can you believe that? Wow. One grocer now sells 25% of all our food. And 15 years ago, it didn't sell any. One website now sells 33% of everything we buy online. Big business is getting bigger. Small business is getting smaller. This, ladies and gentlemen, leads us to the crux of the issue of scale and survival. What happens when medium-sized business becomes, as the saying goes, roadkill? Wow. This is going to be something that we have to come to grips with. How will big business then continue to get bigger, as it certainly must, if not by taking that share from small businesses and from individuals? Will big business make it impossible for individuals to grow food for their communities and themselves in order to continue expanding its market share? This thought, and the fact that citizens across the land are now being persecuted for growing their own food on their own property, lead us to ask, can we just shop our way back to a strong local economy? Well, here to help us shop for an answer, we have the goddess of localism, Stacy Mitchell, who is the senior researcher for the Institute of Local Self-Reliance. Stacy, welcome to the Food Chain.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Well, we're very happy to have you. We were talking a little bit before the show on how we, when we're in the process of organizing our Think Local First organization for our local community, everybody talked about Stacy Mitchell. And so we're really happy to have you aboard the Food Chain to talk about localism. First of all, you're in Portland, Maine, right?
Yes.
I've always wanted to see Portland, Maine, but to see Portland, Maine, you have to go to Portland, Maine, because you can't just get there while trying to get someplace else, right?
That is right. We're really at the end of the country.
Good enough for you. Well, you're the author of The Big Box Swindle. Tell us about The Big Box Swindle.
Well, it's a book I wrote a few years ago about consolidation in the retail economy, so the growth of these huge retail chains, Walmart, Target, Home Depot, and how they had really were transforming our economy, not only the retail sector, but how and where things are produced and manufactured, the food that's grown. I mean, all throughout the economy, these companies have really changed things, and I argued in the book for the worse. And the book looks really at the impact of those big box retailers, and the swindle really is that I think, you know, we think we're getting a bargain shopping in those stores when in fact we're paying this enormous cost in lost income, in environmental degradation, and the demise of communities and democracy, really. The second part of the book looks, you know, at the growing number of grassroots movements around the country to reverse that and the effects that those local campaigns are having.
And there you go. And now you're a senior researcher for the Institute of Local Self-Reliance. What is that?
It's a national nonprofit organization that's been around since 1974. With this philosophy of building strong local economies. And we work across a variety of different sectors. You know, my focus is on retail and banking. My colleagues who work on the energy sector, on telecommunications, and so on. And we design rules and strategies to help communities and policymakers and businesses reinvent our economy in a way that is much more community-rooted and more humanly scaled.
Fair enough. We always like to ask who pays the way. Who pays the way for the Institute of for Local Self-Reliance?
We're mostly foundation-funded. We have some individual donors, and, of course, you know, a chunk of our funding depends on small donations from across the country. So, like many nonprofits, we need people's support.
Well, good. In preparing for the show, of course, I watched your TEDx talk on why we can't shop our way to a better economy. Stacy Mitchell, why can't we shop our way to a better economy?
Well, we've had this, you know, and I've been very much involved and a great supporter of this, you know, buy local movement that has emerged over the last decade and has really done a lot of good, you know, both in the food sector, but also just across the economy. You know, we've seen independent business alliances and local first campaigns, and the level of public awareness has really been raised. More and more people are thinking about local versus corporate when they make spending decisions, and that's really terrific. But my concern at this point is that that alone is not going to get us where we need to go. That we, you know, we can point to these successes. You mentioned a few of them, the growth of farmers markets and neighborhood grocery stores. We've had 500 new independent bookstores open since 2004. You know, there are a lot of things that we can point to that have been a result of this shift. And the choices that people are now making with how they spend their dollars. But I don't think that's going to amount to enough to really challenge the larger forces that we're working against. Just to take the food sector as one example, you know, while we've had this explosion of local food and all kinds of measures of that out there and how quickly it's growing and so on, it still amounts to a relatively small sliver of the food system.
Not even a hill of beans, right?
Not even a hill of beans. And in that same space of time, in that same sort of 15 years that you've seen that local food movement grow, we've also had a single company, Walmart, grow from selling essentially no groceries to capturing one out of every $4 that Americans spend on food. And, of course, it's controlling the whole food chain, causing consolidation up among, you know, meat packers and various processing companies, you know, and industrializing our whole food system. So, you know, the question I've begun to ask is, what, you know, why is that? And I think as consumers, we're pretty weak. You know, if you think about it, what we're trying to do is to align all of these, you know, millions of individual spending decisions, and it's very hard for any, you know, for all of us to make all of the right choices all of the time. And it also really fails to grapple with the fact that these companies rose to dominance not just because of their popularity with consumers. It wasn't just market forces that gave us Walmart.
They had a secret ingredient, didn't they?
They did. That's right. And that's government support. You know, our public policy is just riddled with tax loopholes that benefit big corporations, a farm bill where, you know, 80% of the dollars go to the top 10% of all farms. All these giveaways and subsidies, you know, Walmart picks up public money almost everywhere it builds a store. You don't see that going, you know, to local businesses. So the whole system is rigged. And it's rigged because these guys have political power, and they're able to go to Congress and to our state legislatures and sometimes our city councils and get favorable deals and handouts and special treatment that local businesses aren't.
And you think that we need to fight them on that basis, right?
Is that
what you're...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Folks, you're tuned into the Food Chain Radio program. Today we have Stacy Mitchell. She's the goddess of localism and senior researcher for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and Michael Olson. Michael Olson's going to take the other side of the coin here and argue that, hey, I think we can do it all just by spending $2 a day on local food. Ooh, this is going to be interesting. Who do you agree with? Stacy Mitchell or Michael Olson? 831-479-1080 is the phone call today. Pick up your phone and join us. Can we survive on just being good shoppers? What do you think? Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, we're back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking localism. Can we shop our way to a strong local economy? We have Stacy Mitchell with us. She's the senior researcher for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Is there a difference between local self-reliance and self-reliance, Stacy Mitchell?
Yes, there is.
What is
it? Good question. Well, self-reliance, I think, evokes a sort of individualism, whereas local self-reliance is really about community self-reliance. So what we're saying is that this is about local communities that care for one another, that there's a network of mutual aid at the local level.
And when it gets right down to it, it's going to become increasingly more important, I believe, that communities learn how to take care of themselves. Because if you look at what's going on in Washington, D.C. and state capitals around the country, you got to just scratch your head and think, how are we going to survive? And I think we can survive if we learn how to take care of each other. And I kind of guess that that's what the Institute of Local Self-Reliance is all about. Fair enough?
That's right. I think that's absolutely right. You know, you look at the precariousness of our global systems, you know, these long-distance supply chains, you know, that bring us the goods that we use. And I think that's all very vulnerable. And I think local communities are going to really need to be focusing on, you know, how to reinvent their economies on their own terms and to take care of themselves.
Well, let's go back a little bit, Stacy, and we talked about how companies are coming to really dominate their industrial sectors, food not being any exception, of course. Let's pick up a couple. Let's talk about milk.
Yeah, you know, we've got one company now that processes 40% of the nation's milk supply. And here in New England, where I live, it's 70% of our milk is all through Dean Foods. Just astonishing. And if you're a farmer, of course, that means it's pretty hard to get a fair price for your milk because often, you know, given the expense of transporting milk, you may only have that one choice in terms of where you can sell it.
You know, it's really interesting how the industrialization of the food chain has really turned farmers into kind of like serfs on their own land.
You can
grow cows and you can have them produce milk, but you can only sell your milk to one place, which is going to pay you exactly what they want to pay you, which leaves you not much, does it?
That's right, and declining. You know, we just put out an infographic a few weeks ago about sort of starting from the standpoint of Walmart's takeover of the food system, but then looking at how that's caused all these mergers among processing companies. And right across the board, you see the share, the amount that farmers are getting for what they produce has just dropped dramatically, whether it's beef or milk or vegetables. And meanwhile, consumers are paying more, and it's, you know, it's the big supermarket chains and the food processors that are pocketing that difference.
So if we're consumers out here in the world, we should take heart in the fact that our farmers aren't making anything, right?
makes us
feel really secure in
right,
the notion
exactly.
that our farmers are starving and somebody else is taking all of their money. Walmart, 15 years ago, wasn't selling any food, and today 25% of all the food that America buys is purchased at Walmart. How in the heck did that happen?
Yeah, they've gotten green-lighted to build stores all across the country, and they have just unrolled these super centers after another. You know, and often they come in with very low prices, and people go there, and then when the local competition disappears, those prices rise. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward predatory system that they've got going. And, you know, there are 37 metro areas where Walmart now has more than half of all food sales. So this is the direction that they want to go, and they're on a trajectory to do that unless we say no.
You know, I was driving through a Central Valley on Highway 99, which is kind of like the old highway that goes through California's Great Central Valley, and I came upon this little town that was completely empty. And I thought, wow, it's just deserted. What happened? And down the road a mile, there was a Walmart. And that's what happened to small-town America, I guess. There you go. So how did these companies get so big, though? I mean, they do have economies of scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've done it in a couple of ways. One is that they've depended heavily on government support. So just to stick with the Walmart example, Walmart's picked up over $1 billion in local subsidies to offset its building costs. So this is where Walmart comes into a town and says, we want to build a store here. Give us a $7 million property tax break, or give us a big piece of land for free. And they go all over the country, and they pick up those kinds of deals. And, of course, none of that kind of public support is made available to competing local businesses. They also benefit a lot from tax loopholes. We all have gotten somewhat familiar with these overseas tax havens where companies do these sort of shenanigans with on paper where they move profits around and then escape paying federal income taxes. They also do it at the state level in many states. So they've got subsidiaries in other states that own their, own their trademark, and they pay, quote, a fee to that other, you know, so they've got one part of the company paying a fee to another part of the company, treating it as a business expense instead of profits, and then not paying state's income taxes on it. Small business can't do that.
I have a way of describing this to, if I might, to small farmers that I'm working with, and I tell them that they must learn how to compete with the competition's strengths and weaknesses. And, of course, the strength of large is the economies of scale. And yeah. I describe these economies of scale thusly. Let's say Stacy Mitchell and Ricochet, engineer Ricochet, are going to go out and buy a $10,000 tractor. Now, Stacy Mitchell has a one-acre farm, and engineer Ricochet has a 1,000-acre farm. And one day they go out and buy a $10,000 tractor. Well, how much does that tractor cost? How much does it cost Stacy Mitchell? $1,000, $10,000. Ricochet, $10,000. But wait, Stacy Mitchell has 1 acre, so that tractor costs $10,000 per acre. And Ricochet has 1,000 acres, so it's only $10. Thus, it's really hard to compete with a Goliath when competing on that level, on that $10,000 tractor with 1,000 acres. Now, let's say you're going to go by a government, a decision from government. What do they call it? Campaign contribution. Certainly they don't call it bribes, but they call it something. And it costs $10,000. Now, Stacy Mitchell, with her 1 acre piece of property, has to pay $10,000 per acre for that government decision. Whereas Ricochet, with his 1,000 acres, only has to pay $10 per acre. And that's how I describe the advantages of economies of scale. Mm-hmm. And if you have those advantages, government is pretty easy to work with and to influence. And thus we have a situation today where Monsanto's Michael Taylor is now the food safety czar for the United States of America.
Mm. Well, you know, what I think is particularly sort of shocking when you get right down to it is the first economy of scale that you described, you know, the fact that if you operate at a bigger scale, you have more acres, you can spread those costs out, you can do things more efficiently. That's true up to a certain size. And then once you reach a certain size, it's not true anymore. And sometimes it actually reverses.
Correct.
So, you know, the volume, the ability of a company like Walmart to buy in volume or operate its distribution centers efficiently, that level of scale quite a long time ago. So all of its growth since then isn't really adding anything in terms of economies of scale. It's mostly sheer market power and predatory behavior that's enabled
the ability
to continue growing.
And the ability to influence government. And thus, we have a situation where all of those billions of dollars, or most of those billions of dollars in farm bill money, so subsidies, they don't go to the family farmer serving the community, do they?
That's right. That's right. And banks are another really sort of easy to see example of this. I mean, the economists who look at efficiency in banks find that a bank is most efficient at a size that's sort of like a small regional bank. After that, they actually suffer from diseconomies of scale. They get so big and top-heavy that they're more expensive to operate. You know, these big banks today, the J.P. Morgan Chase and the Bank of America, are just many, many, many times larger than they actually need to be to operate most efficiently.
And thus, five banks now control, 46% of all of our cash? Oh, my goodness. Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Stacy Mitchell and you. Can we shop our way to a strong local economy? What do you think? 831-479-1080, 479-1080. When we come back, I'm going to ask Stacy, what's wrong with big? Do stay tuned. Hey, what do you think? Do you think we can eat our way and shop our way back to a strong local economy? That's a question on the table today. 831-479-1080. We're picking up some callers, and we'll pick them up in just a moment. Right after I ask Stacy Mitchell, she the senior researcher for the Institute of Local Self-Reliance, what's wrong with being big? What's wrong with Walmart?
Well, these companies are really drawing wealth out of our communities and undermining the middle class and undermining democracy. I mean, Walmart, for example...
Is that all?
Well, there's a lot more, but I thought I'd start someplace. You know, Walmart is, you know, when you look at the shrinking of the American middle class and the rising numbers of working poor, you know, people who work full-time but have to, you know, take public benefits and stuff to just meet the basics of daily living, you know, I think a lot of that trend we can really put at the feet of the sort of Walmart economic model, where these big companies have undermined these key pillars of the American middle class. They've undermined small businesses and independent farmers and so on, and they've undermined American manufacturing, driven all those jobs overseas. In exchange for that huge loss to the middle class, what have we gotten? We've gotten very low-wage jobs working at their stores. And that's pretty much the crux of kind of the economic challenge that we're facing right now. You know, another problem... Oh, go ahead.
No, but some would say that they're like giant vampires sucking the life out of America, but I certainly wouldn't say that myself.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's the great vampire squid, right? Isn't that my Taibbi's phrase for Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, there you go.
And the banks as well. I mean, you know, we've created a banking system that cannot finance the real economy that we depend on. A banking system that basically does gambling on Wall Street, is very bad at small business lending, and does very little of it. And, you know, it's no wonder that we've got an economy where local businesses are just starved for credit and unable to grow, and we're all suffering the effects of that.
And there you go. Well, we're going to go to the phones, but first I'd like to offer up my way of taking on these giants, and I call it the 2x2 pledge, and I've been kind of preaching it around when I give speeches here and there, but I suggest that we can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom simply by spending $2 per day on local food and talking two other people into doing the same thing. Now, if this progression progresses as it should, soon everybody in the community will be spending $2 a day on local food. Now, in my marketplace, there are 500,000 people. And if everybody is buying $2 a day, that's $1 million a day in cold, hard cash in a local economy circulating around, $365 million a year. Now, when money circulates locally, it has a way of compounding itself. We in our Think Local First organization just circulated five $100 checks through the local economy for 30 days, and we kept track of it. And those five $100 checks generated $8,811 worth of local business in 30 days just by staying in the community. Now, were we to have redeemed those checks at a big box store, the kind that Stacy Mitchell writes about in Big Box Swindle, the money would, of course, would have disappeared. But since it circulated that way, it has a way of building a strong local economy. So I believe that if we each spend $2 per day and talk to other people into doing it, soon there will be a very vibrant local economy with lots of money circulating around. There will be butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. Now, there is a precedent for this, and it's a huge, giant one. And it happened in China, where the Chinese Communist government had the country divided into urban and the country. And they had a giant wall built between the two, and they would not let people in the country into the city. They were prisoners on the land. And nothing the farmers could do to stop it. They would stand up with their pitchforks and say, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to be slaves to the city. And the government would come in and shoot them. And that would be the end of that. But once one peasant farmer figured out that, gee, maybe if I could just talk the local cadre into working with me, he would. And so he went to the local cadre and said, hey, if I grow this food and you let me sell it, I'll split the profits with you. And that, ladies and gentlemen, was how Professor Kate Xiaozhou of the University of Hawaii said that the farmers changed China. And I think we can do that here with two by two. $2 per day on local food, two other people to do the same thing. What do you think about that one, Ms. Stacy Mitchell?
I think that's a great idea. I would add one more, which is I think that we need to start thinking about our sort of change the world energy in two ways. I think we need to spend, you know, part of it on changing the choices that we make and that our neighbors make, and I think we need to spend the other part of it on acting collectively as citizens. And it can be sort of overwhelming to look at the number of issues out there that are so important. But I would say pick one. You know, pick one thing that you're really passionate about and work with your neighbors to make a change at the local level or at the state level or to lobby members of Congress on that issue. Because I think, you know, it's easy to imagine that in theory, if we could just all change our spending habits, that we would eventually get the kind of economy that we want. But I think that we're swimming a bit uphill on that if that's the only thing that we do.
Okay.
There are people who live in parts of the country where local food is not an option. It doesn't exist. There are people who feel really challenged by, feeling like I can get a McDonald's hamburger for less than I can get a pound of broccoli.
I'm not asking for everything. I'm just asking for $2 a day.
Well, yeah, I'm totally on board with it, but I think it's got to be that and something else. Because, you know, you think about it, the average person spends $15,000 a year. So $2 a day is, what, $700?
Mm-hmm.
So we end up with an economy that's sort of $700 local and $14,300.
Oh, but see, I don't think it just stays
corporate
with $2 a day, because I think once we learn how much fun it is to buy local, we go from $2 a day to maybe $5 or $10.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that now let me address the whole notion before we go to the phones about petitioning the government to take care of us. See, I'm of the opinion that the government is owned. Big government is owned lock, stock, and barrel by big business. How mm-hmm. else would you describe the fact that Monsanto's Michael Taylor is now in charge of food safety at the federal Food and Drug Administration? Michael Taylor just put out rules and regulations about how we may or may not grow food. Now, I haven't had a chance to look at those rules yet, but I suspect I know who helped write them, and it wasn't local farmers. And so I suspect that if we go to the government and ask for help, like the organic farmers did when they petitioned the government to protect their organic labeling, that we're going to find ourselves in deep doo-doo, because we always do. And the reason we always do, I think, is because the government is owned by those big boys. That's my position. Stacy Mitchell says we have to go the other direction, but that's the dialogue on the table. Now we're going to go to the phones and see what you think. Can we buy our way back to a strong local economy just by shopping, just by eating local? What do you think? 831-479-1080. Well, what about it, folks? Can we shop our way back to a strong local economy, or must we stand up to the man and demand that they take better care of us? That's kind of the two directions we're talking about. I think Stacy Mitchell would agree with me. She's the senior researcher for the Institute of Local Self-Reliance, in the fact that we simply must start using our local economy, or we're going to lose it, period. But Stacy would suggest that we petition the government to take better care of us. Personally, I don't think the government's going to take better care of us. I think the government is owned lock, stock, and barrel by those who don't want to compete with local. And is that fair enough, Stacy?
Well, I think that's true now, but I'm not giving in.
Good for you. I'm not either, but I thought, what would have we work with this and see where we go from here. Let's go to the phones, and we're going to start right now with Teresa. Teresa, are you there?
I am.
Welcome to the food chain. Thank you for joining us.
First, I have to say, Stacy, I'm a big fan of yours, your organization, and your newsletter, so I will just admit my bias right up front. but I want to take up this discussion of whether the 2x2 solution will really work, Michael.
Fair enough. Pick on me then. You're not going to pick on Stacy, so go ahead and pick on me.
What you're talking about is what Michael Schumann calls the multiplier effect.
Yep.
That when money continues to circulate in the local economy, it replenishes and enriches the entire community. Now, that would be true if that money stayed local. But where every time that money changes hands, there's an average of 20% that goes into federal taxes. There's another 10%, which if you're self-employed, you're paying both parts of, that goes into payroll taxes, Social Security and Medicare. Both of those go to the federal government, which they then can use to subsidize those agricultural corporations and also for foreign interventions to keep the price of producing low.
Yeah, taxes cut two ways. Taxes are like a double-edged sword. First of all, they cut one of your hands off because they take your money out of your pocket. Then they cut the other arm off by taking your money and giving it to your competitor.
Right, absolutely. And the Social Security slush fund, the money they have in reserve, they've used for military toys that they don't have to ask for permission to buy. So then you go to the state level. And here in California, we pay another 10% in state taxes. If it's a product other than food, you're going to pay 10% in sales tax. And even our property taxes don't stay local. They leave, mm-hmm. and then they come back to us with strings attached. But then let's talk about the properties themselves. I've been reading about the zombie mortgages and about Matt Taibbi's new article on secrets and lies of the bank's bailouts. So because the banks create the money out of nothing in order to buy those properties, they end up getting 30% on average of our income just to pay them for the houses that they're holding hostage over us. There's no reason that it has to be that way. That money could be supporting our local community. So at that point, you're up to, like, you know, 70-80%
of your money.
And then you have things like, right, of that income. And then you have things like insurances, you know, which are another big chunk that you can't buy locally. So of that $100 check that you guys are circulating, you're supplementing it each time it changes hands with, I would guess, you know, 90% of your own money.
Now, Teresa, you're being so darn picky. and of course, you're absolutely right. But let me ask you this. That being the case, what happens to what share of the money stays in town when you take it down to the box store?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's no question. What you're talking about is what we should do and what, of course, you know, of course I do. But I'm just saying...
And furthermore, why can't we have local insurance?
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of things
Stacey,
we can do.
Stacey, has anybody ever talked about that? Local insurance?
I think it's a big thing, but we have to take back those debt assets. We can't let the banks own our houses and our children.
Amen. Teresa, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. We're going to... Stacey, what about local insurance?
You know, I haven't thought about that a whole lot, but I think, you know, you would have to have a sort of big enough pool to diversify risks. So, you know, it maybe needs to be more of a regional thing.
I mean,
if your
county
town got hit by some kind of disaster and everyone was affected, mm-hmm. you would sort of want to be in a bigger pool. But there, it seems like...
Hey, you know, disaster is really good business this year, these days. Do you see about the disaster assistance going to the Sandy storm? Holy smokes. They're buying bridges in Alaska with that.
Yeah, well, and we heard all those years, we heard congressmen and big companies say that, you know, it was too expensive to fix climate change. You know, obviously, that was a load of...
I think climate change is big business these days. Let's go to Lowell. Lowell, welcome to the Food Chain. You've got Stacy Mitchell.
Good morning, Stacy. Good morning, Michael. Hope everyone is well. The business of local makes a lot of sense in my estimation, but to get the government involved or have the government control it or have the government come in and help us with it makes no sense whatsoever, in my opinion. The government is going to do it with their own things, and the lady before me took a lot of my thunder on this kind of thing. Whatever they do for us is going to be done by taking it from us first, to whether it's us or the guy next door or somebody else.
Hey, Lowell, I have to take a quick break. Can you hold for us?
Absolutely.
Finish this. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. So much to talk about, so little time to talk about it in, but do stay tuned. We will be right back after these messages. Michael Olson, Stacy Mitchell, and you, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain. Well, we have a few minutes to go and so much to talk about and so little time. Let's go back to Lowell. Lowell, are you still there? Are you still there, Lowell?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. Quick, fire away.
I liked your last ad. I'll be very brief on that, Mr. Flaminski. That's definitely local money. That's something found here, and when he sells it, the money comes in here. Very nicely done. I'll get back, however, to what I'm thinking about the government and what have you. Just always remember that there is nothing that the government can ever give you or do for you that hasn't been taken from somebody else and yourself. It doesn't make sense for the government to be doing much.
Are you trying to tell us that the government doesn't make money?
Oh, well, the government certainly makes it after they get the permission from the Federal Reserve System to print it. And as soon as they print it, then you and I owe it, plus the interest on it, even though this Federal Reserve System didn't give us anything. The government is spending 40% of every dollar that they do spend by borrowing it first, and now you and I owe it. It's a bad, bad system.
Okay, Stacy Mitchell, what do you think about that?
I'm not suggesting that the federal government run our local economies, but I am suggesting, just to take banking as one example, You know, for 50 years, from the Great Depression, you know, into the 1990s, we had rules that prohibited banks from growing across state lines, from getting involved in gambling on Wall Street. And the result was we had a banking system that was incredibly stable, very few failures.
What happened to that banking system?
Mostly locally owned community banks. We rewrote all those rules. You know, we had big bankers and, you know, Democrats and Republicans, you know, came together in a bipartisan effort to change the entire banking system.
And I know what happened, Stacey. See, what happened is that Ricochet, with his 1,000-acre farm, went and donated liberally to somebody and changed the banking rules.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And he donated, you know, mainly to the Democratic Party. I mean, that was, you know, that's who did a lot of that banking deregulation. We need to get back to that. And I'm not going to accept the idea that our government has been taken over by these big corporations.
Okay.
You know, we need to get back.
I like an optimist. Thank you very much for being an optimist for me. Let's see. Let's go to Rick, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead. Fire away with Stacey Mitchell and Michael Olson and you.
I was going to say I'd rather go a different route than the money, because the government does control the money along with everything else they're telling us. And the rule of thumb is whatever the government tells you is good is bad, and whatever they say is bad is good. And that's things like eggs and margarine or eggs and butter and salt are all bad, but those are all good things.
Are you saying that we should go to our doctor and trade him a chicken for some...
No, what we should do is we should pick an item that's bad, like aspartame and gum and soft drinks, or fluoride in their water, and pick one thing, but especially in the terms of buying food products, pick an item, and it takes 21 days to form a habit. Have people educated as to how bad this is, and have them stop it for 30 days, and if they've done it for 30 days, they will continue to do it.
Well, thank you for that call. That was very interesting. Stacey, what do you think?
Yeah, we've got a lot of bad habits we could change maybe in 30 days. That'd be good.
Okay, let's go quickly to Don. Don, you're last.
Thanks, Michael. I don't know quite where to start. So.
Well, it's too late to be there because the music's coming on.
When Costco located in the Santa Cruz city limits, the Sentinel published an article about it in which Jim Buse implied that the city council did cut a sales tax deal with Costco to get their to get them to locate in the city limits.
And what happened really quickly?
And nobody ever talked about it after that. It was just was allowed to die as a thought. But I'm certain that Jan Dietz was correct.
Well, okay, we're kind of out of gas, Don, but thanks for the try. Stacey Mitchell, thank you so much. How do we get in touch with Stacey Mitchell?
You can write to me if you just go to the Institute for Local Self-Reliance website at ilsr.org.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for tuning in. See you next week.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.